Og han utpekt som en keynote speaker. It's a pleasure to welcome Andreas Weigand. He's from the United States, San Francisco actually. And he worked as an independent consultant for international brands like MySpace, Yahoo, Lufthansa, Nokia and Volkswagen. And he's been a chief scientist in Amazon.com. On his website, he simply says that he's studying people and the data they create. So let's see where that will take us. And he is also encouraging you to ask questions if you'd like during the speech. So welcome, Andreas. I'm looking forward to see what you are going to tell us.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It's actually hard to believe this is the first time in my life that I'm in Norway. And I know that my mom, when she was 14 years old, she went to Norway and she loves the pictures. I still remember the pictures she showed me. So actually, it's really, really amazing for me to finally be here and to see, after I arrived last night, what a lovely city Oslo is. I don't know whether somebody specially ordered the lovely weather today, but it really is so crisp and wonderful outside the ship, the new opera building, and thank you for putting me up in this great hotel next door. So what I want to do with you, and it's now 5 minutes to 10. Until what time do I have? I want to make sure.
About 10:35, 10:40.
Okay, so I will speak until 10:35. And then we have 5 minutes for questions. And if in between you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. And I will either accommodate them right away or we'll do it afterwards at the end. I'm also here for the break. And if you have deeper questions, I'm very, very happy to work with you during the break. The title of my presentation is The Impact of the Consumer Data Revolution on CRM and Dialogue Marketing. Let's unpack this title first. Consumer Data Revolution, CRM, Dialogue Marketing. So let's start from the end. Dialogue marketing means that there are two parties talking to each other. When I say dialogue, I don't mean that, for instance, your financial institution sends you a piece of paper every month saying a dialogue with your fund manager, a person you have never met. How can I have a dialogue with somebody I've never met? So one element which we get to here is, where does this dialogue take place? CRM is a term probably most of you know, customer relationship management. Now, that also is an interesting term because do you really want to be managed by the company? Or do you want to actually, you know, have some say in the process? So the relationship and the CRM always reminds me of fly paper. You know, in the summer when you have these fruit flies, and a fly comes, puts his leg there, and now it gets managed because it has all these lovely things you eat there and so on and so forth. So that's the problem with CRM, that the notion of CRM in many cases is not an empowering notion of the customer, but viewing the customer just as an object and not really doing justice to the world we live in, namely the customer having a voice. So this presentation here is about trying to figure out how companies can have a dialogue, a true and genuine dialogue with their customer, how they can profit from the voice rather than being worried about what the customers may say. And then finally, it is about the consumer data revolution. And let me explain this at the beginning. What is that thing, the consumer data revolution? As you heard, I was the chief scientist of Amazon.com. And Amazon is truly a brilliant company where everything you have ever done is still recorded. That is the first data revolution. You clicked at an item, even if you decided to not buy it, we know that you clicked at that item. You know, one of the best performing recommendation features is to take item which you put into your wish list and show them to you half a year later. And people always say, wow, Amazon understands so well what I'm interested in. And that's an example of just knowing what you've clicked at. These are mainly what are called implicit data, and it really has only become possible in the last decade in the online business. Because if I want to, for instance, walk into a bank, or if I walk into a bookstore, you know, they don't know what I'm interested in. And it would be really weird if somebody followed you and every time you look at a book, they take note. I think we would be quite uncomfortable that way. But the important thing about what are called data strategies is that in Amazon, it has to be that way, because if Amazon is showing you something about a book, it has to know what book it should be showing you something to. So it's very different, the attitude we have towards the information in the online world, where we know we need to reveal everything. And believe me, people do reveal everything if you think about search engines. Who of you would be comfortable if your best friend saw every single search you did on Google? So we do trust those boxes a lot. So Amazon has a lot of data, and I call those implicit data. The second data revolution is the data revolution where the customers, and we are all customers here, do not only show those things which they gotta show for the machine to bring something back to them, but they voluntarily and happily reveal all kinds of information. Who of you has an account on Facebook? Okay, so about half of you. In America, the average time a student spends on Facebook is 40 minutes a day. So, for instance, an important element is to make sure that you update your picture all the time. And, I mean, I still have the same picture up on Facebook I had at the very beginning, but when you go to a party, somebody takes a picture, the one criterion is, will this be a good picture on Facebook for the next hour? So, Facebook is an example of people constantly providing new information about themselves. But the powerful thing is not only that it's about information about themselves. Much more powerful is that it provides information about others. So when you go to a party, you might not even know that somebody is snacking that picture of you and tagging you as Andreas Weigand. I mean, not you, me, as Andreas Weigand. And that is actually much more powerful. Those relationships people unveil about each other. Let me give you a practical example. I don't know, is anybody here from the telecommunications industry? Okay. AT&T did a study where they did traditional state-of-the-art marketing with segmentation, taking psychographics, demographics, past calling behavior, etc. into account, to sell a new product. And let's call this as a baseline of a level of 100, the percentage of products they sold. Then they compared this to the simplest way how you could imagine you would sell the product. And that is, if you bought a product, then of course they know who the people are you call, because after all, that's the business the phone company is in to keep record of that. So they just simply said, hey, the people you called the nearest neighbors in the graph, we offer the product to them, irrespective psychographics, demographics, calling behavior. What do you think if the previous one was a level of 100? What do you think only leveraging the social graph? Where do you think that went? Above 100? Below 100? Any guesses who thinks it's better than 100? Yeah, of course. Otherwise, I wouldn't give it to you as an example, okay? So it is actually 480. So they sold almost five times as much. With a simple rule, let's market to the people who are connected to the people who actually bought the product. Now, implicitly, of course, in this connection, there's a lot implied that people might be similar socioeconomic structure, and so on. But all that aside, a simple fact is that in this world where people give explicit data often about their friends, we have very, very powerful new ways of reaching the customers, and not only of us reaching the customers. We can also, and that gets to my first question, who talks to whom, have the customers talk to each other. Sometimes this is called viral marketing. And if you think about the choices we have, then I want to start with a little movie which features Jonathan Schwartz. And Jonathan Schwartz is the CEO of Sun Microsystems, a company which makes computers and which makes actually big computers. So you don't buy a Spark Station just for your home usage. He makes supercomputers, which you can, you know, all you need is power, water, and internet access. And you can wheel it in your parking lot, and you have a supercomputer there. So it's not a B2C company. It's not a C2C company. What it does is it makes big boxes. So Jonathan Schwartz is being asked in this interview by a company called Technorati what he thinks the impact is of this social media or, you know, this new marketing on his company.
Oh, I think it had an enormous impact because so many people said, these folks they got a spine. I mean, if they're willing to actually put the good, the bad, and the ugly right out on the front page, then they must be either pretty proud of their products or really ready to go put the right R&D behind them to make them absolutely fabulously successful. So I think we got a lot of points for being courageous, for being innovators, for having the confidence to be able to step forward and say, here's where we think the industry is headed. We use Technorati as a mechanism to ensure we continue to drive transparency. You're, in a way, an honest broker for us. You don't step in the middle and filter out, make sure we only get the best stuff. We get the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we use as much of that as possible to make better decisions going forward. That's, in effect, what communications is all about, the connection to the marketplace is all about. The more we know, the better we can do. And to me, that's a competitive weapon. That's a competitive advantage.
Okay, so why did I show this to you? I wanted to give you an example that this data revolution is there, is present, that people are talking somewhere about your products, about your companies, even in this case, if it's big business companies, big business products, not just the small digital camera or the Nokia phone you bought. So that's just the world we live in. Okay, now, one way of looking at this is to really focus on the data, and sometimes I call this conversational data, and I want to just give you some very quick examples of what Google actually knows about you. Because if we talk about the consumer data revolution, then it's the implicit data, the explicit data, and how consumers think about this. All this is done in the purpose of giving US marketing people ideas what to do in multi-channel marketing. Very briefly, what does Google know about you? Of course, it knows the searches. It, of course, for those of us who have Gmail, and I'm curious, who has Gmail here? Again, majority of people, it knows actually the social relationships. And we saw already that those are important. It knows also, if you allow it to actually look at the contents of the email, it knows what you're interested in. And it actually can show you ads in that context. Then there's a Google toolbar, which knows how are you traveling through the universe of the web. It follows users across sites. You can use Google Notes, which is annotate pages. So there you are at the dating site, and you want to annotate that special person that, you know, you would like to talk to at some stage. Google Analytics. I at Weigen.com am running Google Analytics. So even if you don't use any Google, if you never ever went to the site, if you don't ever would touch Gmail, I know that you are coming to my page, and so does Google. There's Google Reader, which is a way of dealing with so-called RSS feeds. So your bank, for instance, might have some news it sends to people through RSS, which is real simple syndication. It's a way of you reading blogs and other things. So if you have Google Reader, Google knows what you're interested in. What's a short click versus a long click? A short click means you just spend, you know, a second there. And probably you were not all that interested in it, otherwise you would have spent more time in it. Whereas this long click, you spend a minute there and actually read the article. But it's not only about you, it's also about your friends. It is those attention gestures that you forward the article to somebody. You might actually mark it, you might tag it, and so on and so forth. Then there is Google Docs. Just again, a feeling, who of you has used Google Docs? Okay, it's about a quarter of the audience. Google Docs is really great because you can share a document and you can actually edit it at the same time. So, for instance, when we work together on the conference agenda, what we could have done instead of emailing Word documents back and forth, we could have just opened a Google document. I could have invited Lil, and she could have written something, I could have written something, and I see hers appear, she sees mine appear. What's in for Google? Google knows that Lil and I are working on something. And if you just do a simple parser, they know when the conference is happening, where it's happening, and what it's about. Google Groups, you know, again, the social aspects. Google Talk. So if you come to a web page and I'm actually logged in, you can just click there and we can have a conversation. From that, Google managed to capture content. Google Maps. Google Maps actually quite useful and works really well here. It tells you within 50 meters, and you said even better than GPS because of the density of cell towers in Norway. It tells you where you are, where you want to go to. Hey, where you want to go to? What can you do as an advertiser if Google knows where you want to go to? If I say I'm here now, or they know where I am, I don't have to tell them, and I want to go to the opera in the evening, how about stopping over for a glass of champagne at the Opera Cafe? Calendar also has an important element of the future, that I write down that today I'm going to London, Friday I'm going to Zurich, Saturday I'm going to Frankfurt. So it's the same notion that it's very actionable for advertisers. The last two examples are more business-oriented. It seems that Google is helping you out with design tools. For instance, you want to put motorized blinds into your house. You measure it, you design it. And then, of course, when you're done, here comes the customized offer from the shop a couple of kilometers away. And that's worth a lot for that shop to have that offer to you, because you have done so much work, you're a really highly qualified lead. Why? Because of all the data Google is collecting for you. And finally, Google Checkout is about 2 years old, from the cradle to the grave, from the first inception that you might be interested in some insurance to the end of actually buying it and how much you were buying for it. Google has a record of that. And I'm jumping over other things like YouTube and so on and so forth. So this was the first part of the talk where I wanted to give you a feeling that there's lots of data about us, companies online know. I start with Amazon, which knows other clicks, and I gave you a second example of Google, two companies you both know well, just seeing how different that world has become. Now it's up to us what we do with it. What we do with it is this picture here. Sometimes it is called conversational marketing. The first question asked, where are those conversations? So traditionally, and many of you are trained as traditional marketers, you think about, here's your company, you reach your customers, the individuals down there, you figure out the message, maybe you test it somewhere, maybe you just push and pray, and well, maybe you measure what's happening. In some way, this is downcasting. This is not really taking the individual as an individual. So what can companies do in dialogue marketing, in CRM? And what is the impact of the consumer data revolution on that? So first thing the company should do is just to listen to those conversations. That's why I showed you that movie of Jonathan Schwartz, where he says those conversations are happening whether we are listening or not. So the very first step you do is get a tool that monitors the conversations that are happening about your company on the web. The investment for that is typically order of $10,000 or euros. So to know what the conversations are, you can, of course, try to do it manually and search about it. But the right thing is to invest about, you know, 5 to 10,000 euros. And that way you get a good landscape and you know where you stand. This might be very different from where you think you know where you stand. So I think if you haven't done anything like this, it's worth giving it a try. Understanding what are the positive things the sphere says, the blogosphere says, the social media say, and what are the criticisms. For instance, to my surprise, you know, every now and then somebody complains about my accent. I can't do much about it, but I didn't expect that. But hey, that's what it is. And then it's up to you whether you decide that, you know, I should go to a speech training to get better enunciation, or whether, you know, it's just the way it is. So you will learn stuff about your companies. Who of you actually has had such a study done or has actually tried to figure out what the web says, social media say about them? Have you tried that, to just listen into the conversation? Anybody else? Okay. One simple thing I do is I have Google Alerts. Just simply when my last name comes up, and I'm lucky that there are not many people with my last name, then I just get an email by Google, so I know if somebody, again, complains about my accent or something like that. That's the first stage. Now, the second stage, the second question is, how do you enter those conversations? And there, the lesson from the last couple of years is, whatever you do, do it honestly, because in this power of transparency, which we are creating, where everybody has a voice, if you do funny things, at some stage it will come out. Very different from before. Examples. There's a company in America called Whole Foods, which makes quite good food. It's a market, high quality market. And they have a very open policy towards many things. For instance, each employee's salary is public. So everybody knows how much everybody else is making. They have also an interesting system where everybody gets a few percent of their income, which they can distribute to anybody they want in the company. So let's say the lady who makes the coffee, who doesn't actually have that high a salary, but people just love her because she's so nice and just, you know, she's the joy and makes them happy. Everybody gives her money and her salary at the end might be higher than that of a VP. So in many ways, Whole Foods is the example of a very open, transparent company. And then last year, in about October, there were those 1,000 messages posted under different names about a company they were considering acquiring. So Whole Foods was thinking about buying a company, and it clearly was a bad idea to acquire the company. You know, they have bad this, bad this, bad this, and bad the other. And then somebody found out that all of those messages, despite from different names, came from the same IP address. And that was the IP address of the CEO of Whole Foods. So what would you do in such a case? When somebody, before acquiring a company, probably in this sort of shareholder value, of, you know, getting it as cheaply as possible, posts 1,000 messages saying, what's all wrong with that other company? Would you fire him? So he didn't get fired. But it's one of those stories, of which we have many, that you really can't hide. He probably at the time wasn't thinking very deeply, but I don't think he ever considered this again. One of the big questions, I was yesterday talking to the CEO of F-Secure, a company in Finland, of the future is really, who takes care of our digital identities? How do we create accountability over time? How do we not only as companies in a one-way mirror, look at the customer. When I call Lufthansa German Airlines for my mobile phone, they say, hello, Dr. Weigand, because they have my number stored and they know it's me. I have no idea who I'm talking to there. And if she says, sure, you can get an upgrade, and I buy the ticket, and I show up at the airport, said, what are you talking about? Upgrade? No way. I have no, this asymmetry. That's one of the problems. How can we get from this one-way mirror, from this information asymmetry, that has served companies quite well, but stop serving them well in this age of transparency, to a feasible, possible, sustainable transparency in this dialogue? So when I call my bank and they tell me something, no, there's no fee associated with the transaction, and then I see my $17 for the wire, well, how can I tell somebody that, you know, somebody said it would be free? Often, I don't know about Norway, but often in America, when you call, they say, for the purpose of, you know, training, this call may be monitored. Do you have that here too? So actually, when I call, let's say, SAS, do they not record the calls?
They record calls.
They okay. So the right consumer answer is to say, hello, I'm Andreas. Since you're the recording call, just want to let you know I'm also recording the call. And then you push the button. That's sort of removing this asymmetry. And then if you go with that recording to the gate agent and says, here is the recording. Would you like to listen about the upgrade? It's a very different situation. So those are all the examples I could give you here. So the first one is to listen to what the customers have to say. And we have one person here who actually knows such tools. The second one is then to see how do you authentically enter those conversations. At the heart of everything is that the world we used to live in looks like this. On top of this pyramid, we have in marketing the few gurus who know, trust me, orange, yeah, orange will just be the right color for this. And then we have the masses on the bottom. That could be also in France, the Académie, the French Academy, which decides on how to spell things, or in German, Duden Redaktion, has gone. It is now that this pyramid has been turned upside down. And it's no longer that only those empowered have the voice, but the balance of power is actually shifting to the customers. So what I want to do in the remaining 10 minutes is go through those four questions with you and also make sure that the bits in your mind actually change if appropriate. And the four questions I have for you here is, first, who talks to whom? So here we have seen the shift from dialogue marketing being defined as a pretty much one-sided dialogue to conversation marketing. Where are the conversations? How can we enter the conversations? And it is really what we call C2C. It is conversations between customers. More than 90% of purchasing decisions, averaged over everything, are influenced by what your friends have bought. More than 90%. The traditional media, like television, at least in the United States, are going down year over year. Newspapers are going down year over year. Two-thirds of what college-age kids in America read comes via their friends. So if we want to reach people, we have to understand how to enter the social realm. And one possibility is, I was just working with a company on that, if you think about Facebook, if you give people ways how they can express themselves. It's a company in Helsinki, I was just there the last 2 days, called Frugo, F-R-U-U-G-O. And one of the things they have is they say, here we make it really easy for you, so you can put a couple of products together, and then you can ask your friends, which one do you think I should buy? And you could do this in email, but I mean, that's too much overhead. And then as it goes on, there's a tally, you vote, you think that, you know, that tie looks better on me than this tie, and once you voted, you see what your other friends have voted. So actually this is very interesting. This is not that different from taking your partner to the shop and say, hey, what do you think I should be buying? That's really a peer-to-peer social aspect, or C2C communication. Second, do you have any questions actually about this first point? Where the conversations happen, who talks to whom? How this has shifted from the one-sided to the two-sided? No questions? Yes?
Can you point to, not questions about it, but could you point to some kind of data, statistics that you can use?
Yes. Absolutely. No, I'm happy to back things up here. Give me 1 second. I will pull the slide for you. Oh yeah, of course. Okay, so this one here is here are the numbers. So those numbers actually are focused on that C2C or viral communication. And that is that, for instance, in the example I just gave you with one user on Facebook telling another user on Facebook something. Why is it so powerful? One is because the content is chosen by the user, not by the marketer. I choose those ties. Second, the context is chosen by me, not by the marketer. And thirdly, the target users are chosen by me, not based on some program. So that is sort of the theoretical quote-unquote underpinning. Here are some numbers. That only 14% of people believe information passed to them by government advertising. So we are not doing well in terms of credibility. On the other hand, 90% trust what their friends and their family tell them. Thirdly, 80% of all consumer decisions influenced by word-of-mouth marketing. Fourthly, about 90% of consumers recommend products or service they like to others. Very normal. You like this, and you talk to your friends about it. You hang out in your office, and somebody has a new gadget, and say, oh, that's so cool. On your phone. I mean, what decides on how you buy your phone? Probably your friend has one, and you think it's cool. Stuff like that. Then, as I mentioned before, the word of mouth advertising is 9 times as effective. And when it is about the comparison to personal selling, it is still 4 times as effective. Now, never mind the exact numbers. They are probably different in Norway from the United States where those numbers come from. But the effect is clearly there. So I can back it up more. I can give you the whole deck here. But in the interest of time, I think this one slide should be enough. Okay. So that was the first point I wanted to make here, namely that the conversation just shifted. Second point is who is in control? Not only who are the conversation partners, but who is in control? I always say that we have moved from e-business, where the company is in the center, like Amazon.com, to me business, where I'm in the center, and what's around me are the companies. People used to be very happy to write reviews on Amazon.com. Why? Well, it makes them immortal and whatever it is, whatever the reasons were. Now, people much rather talk about books or whatever they're buying on their own blog. And hey, Amazon, if you want to listen to it, be my guest. You can link to me. Give me some Google juice. But that is the shift from e-business to me business. When I work with companies, one of the interesting elements always is to have the company discover what true customer centricity means. So when I was a child, I do remember that the slogan of one of the supermarkets was, Der Kunde ist König. The customer is king. I never knew what that really meant. You know, am I going to walk with the crown? I never understood that. But what this really means is so different now. Customer-centric means, for instance, that the metrics you might be using in marketing are not thinking about eyeballs. Who wants to be reduced to the eyeballs? I don't want to be reduced to the eyeballs. But it is metrics, really, how the customer sees the world from himself. So, for instance, if I participate in inviting my friends to look at possible ties, a metric there is how many of my friends responded to me compared to the average. And if I'm not doing so well, what might be possible actions for me to increase that number? So the metrics used to be page views. Not surprisingly, because that comes from the days of handing out people newspapers, right? And now the metrics are much more customer-centric metrics. So when we say here, who is in control, it is the balance of power having shifted by the customer having a voice. And what the challenges for companies, and I'm happy in the break, for instance, to work with any of you to figure out what would be the metrics of engagement, the second generation of metrics, as opposed to the first generation of metrics like unique users or page views. Who cares for a unique user? I care for people actually engaging, for people buying the stuff, for people saying good things about me. How can we measure that? Any questions about this one?
How can you do it?
How can you do it? Okay. The answer is by tracking. And not only by tracking what you do, but also what happens in response to you. So, for instance, Facebook apps, there are 400,000 people, 500,000 people in the world who develop Facebook apps. How many people live in Stockholm? Far away. How many people? 1 million or 500,000? Okay, so about as many people as we have in Oslo, as we speak, develop Facebook applications. So there's a company in San Francisco called Contagion, and what they actually do is they develop metrics for that. So I can show you more, I can give you the pointer. To give you one example, how do you measure how viral something is? You do look in a log plot at the slope, and that's the very robust measure of how you know whether you're doing well or not. And how you do it is by aggregating and comparing your virality to that of the remaining 399,999 Facebook developers. Because there are no God-given numbers here. You can only do it and try to understand how you do in comparison to others. I have more details, but I want to get through because we only have like 5 minutes left. So the third question is here, who actually manages whom? So we talked about flypaper, and we talked about customer relationship management. There's a new term, which Doc Searls at Harvard, the same Doc Searls who wrote 10 years ago the Clue Train Manifesto. Have you heard about the Clue Train Manifesto? Who has heard about it? Couple people. I actually recommend, it's on the web, it's free, you flick through the main thesis of that. It was 10 years ago, people were very visionary, trying to understand the relationship between customers and brands and how the internet, how communication was going to influence that. And in retrospect, they didn't get everything right, but it's still surprising how much they saw a decade before now. Clue Train Manifesto. So Doc Searls has this term VRM, which stands for Vendor Relationship Management. So as opposed to the company having a database of customers and reaching out to those customers, targeting them, figuring out what messages they should send to them, he says, let's actually flip this, that I, as a customer, have a database of companies. And I will put up that I'm interested in flying to Oslo, or flying to Bangkok. And now let's see what comes back. So it's not that the company is the sender and decides who the targets are, but it's that the customer is the sender and decides, hey, I need a banking account which has the following conditions. I want to be able to do this, this, and the other. And here, companies, give me your offers. I promise, here's a deposit. I promise I really want one. But I want to see what my options are. What can you do for me? This is what we call vendor relationship management. Do you have examples for that? For maybe credit cards? What do we have in Norway as examples for first steps towards vendor relationship management? How can you as companies participate in that economy, in that ecosystem? Not yet? So one implicit difference is that the customer relationship management actually isn't customer relationship management. It's much more a transaction-based economy. So I'm flying with SAS today to London, and they, as part of Star Alliance, claim that they treat me well, and actually no gripes against them at all, but there is no relationship. Basically, I buy a ticket, they get me the ticket and say, young man, good luck, and you know, you're on your own. If they make a mistake, if they cancel the plane, it's my problem. If I arrive late at the airport, it's also my problem. So that's transaction economics, that you optimize for the transaction, but you don't genuinely thinking, you don't optimize for the relationship. Let's compare this to relationship economics. Amazon.com is interested on its website to support your decision process. The primary goal really is to make sure that customers discover things they will like down the road, not to push some stuff which has been on the shelf and needs to get rid of down their throats. So the primary purpose is to help people make decisions, and that also means that a third of the stuff which is sold at Amazon actually is sold through third-party vendors. Because Amazon, through careful measuring, figured out that people are more likely to come back and actually also buy from Amazon if they feel they have a choice than if they feel that they are taken hostage somewhere. Airlines are very good in taking you hostage. You go to United Airlines website and try to find a flight between Helsinki and London, which is not a Star Alliance flight. Good luck. No, just, you're here. That's what we show you. That's why we have all these other companies which now are information aggregators, which ultimately prevent people booking with airlines. Because why would I go somewhere where I have no choice compared to getting the feeling, even if I book with United down the road, that was a good decision, that was a no-regret decision. And that's based on information. Side remark, negative reviews actually are good for the business. If you are a retailer and a customer comes to you and says, I want to buy something. And how is this one? I say, actually, you know, this one breaks after second use. How is this one? Oh, you know, this one, you know, everybody brings this back. How is this one? Yeah, this, yeah, I would buy that. Then I'm much more comfortable, much more happy to buy this one than if everything you touch, they say, oh, this is great. Oh, that looks great on you. Oh, you should buy this too. So negative reviews actually have a positive effect. So that is the point that we want to move from CRM to VRM, and it's worth thinking about how actually might your company be having a true relationship with the customer, supporting the decision-making process they have, because money is not the only driver. It's many other things that influence the purchasing decision, including minimizing regret, knowing that you don't get screwed over, knowing that down the road, if actually something happens, you can get back to people. What was Amazon in the 90s is a company called Zappos, Z-A-P-P-O-S, in the 2000s. Zappos, powered by service, I have on my blog, viagen.com/blog, like 10-12 minute interview with Tony Hsieh, who is the CEO. Zappos is an amazing company when it comes to customer service. I just saw Tony last week at a Google conference and talking, and Tony said, hey, Andreas, you know, here's a story for you. And he said he walked through the call center and some guy was ordering pizza. So Tony's a good guy. I said, well, what's up with this? I thought you were working at the call center. Well, Tony, sorry, but you know, somebody from San Diego called me, Zappos, the shoe store in Las Vegas, and said he wanted to order pizza. So what would most of you do? You would say, sorry, wrong number, and hang up. And the employee said, you know, so I took the order. He said he wanted salami pizza, 12 inches, and I took the address and credit card, and I just called Domino's, and I have it delivered to him. True. So do you see this change? That this is much more of a relationship. I tell you that that guy, that story, even if it has cost Zappos maybe $20 in terms of employee time, probably has brought them $10,000 worth of PR value. So it's a big shift from where most of us are. The final question is, since we talked about $10,000 PR value here, the final question is, who pays whom? And now I want to link back to the title here, namely the Consumer Data Revolution and its impact on CRM and dialogue marketing. Let's take GPS data as an example. In America, you can pay $10 a month and you get a subscription about traffic. So it tells you, you know, how bad the traffic is between Stanford and San Francisco at this time of the day, today. But how do they get that information? They get the information by monitoring my GPS device. So I have a GPS device, and they know with which speed it moves on 101, and that way they can have a simple model and tell other people how fast the traffic is on 101. Excuse me, why am I paying $10 if they're using my data? Let's do some other deal here. So we are right now at the very beginning of companies and consumers to start a dialogue and say, hey, okay, you can have all my GPS data except that 5 mile radius of my friend in Arcadia. And then I want to get the service for free because you couldn't have the service without my data. So the question what consumers expect in return and how are the expectations changing are very deep questions with huge implications on marketing. People share data, what do they want to get in return? So to summarize what we talked about in the last 45 minutes is we started with the perspective that what's different now from, say, 15 years ago is that we live in a data-rich world. The data-rich world has both implicit data. Companies can snoop up behind the customers, the experience of the world, and explicit data where customers explicitly, voluntarily share information about their tastes and also about their friends with companies. Implications were, one, viral marketing, that if somebody thinks a product is good, use him or her as your agent to, with zero acquisition cost, as opposed to usual $30-$50, bring new customers to you. Example for that was Amazon Share the Love. If I buy a book, after I bought the book, it says, hey, do you have any friends who might be interested in that book? If any one of them buys the same book within a week, they get 10% discount, you get percent credit, and hey, maybe Amazon actually just sold another book. We then moved and said, okay, what are the implications of this consumer data revolution? One, lots of data about your company and your products out there. It's up to you to listen to them that's a few thousand bucks you should invest to know what people are saying about you. Even if you are a business-to-business company like Sun Microsystems. And the paradigm shift is that if you're open and willing to share what others are saying about you, you're likely, if you have a decent product, to be better off than if you try to suppress it. Why? Because you can't suppress it. Then we said, who is in control? We are moving from e-business to me business. You might want to be in control, but ultimately the balance of power is shifting to the consumer. Customer centricity, of really thinking about the world from the customer's perspective, is done well by companies like Zappos selling shoes, where if somebody calls them up by mistake and wants to order pizza, without missing a beat, they take the order and deliver the pizza. Who manages whom? Don't think anymore too hard about, you know, your database marketing, and think about how can you empower people to actually discover you, and how can you respond to those who are interested in you. And finally, it's about designing incentives so customers can participate, help you, and ultimately we're in the same boat. So it's not that when you call up your airline, you a priori have an antagonistic relationship, but hey, think about the world as that they actually have something which you want and you have something which they want. So on that note, I would like to open up the question, what is this new dialogue and how can we actually do things concretely? Thank you.
Thank you, Andreas. For sure, I understand that information work in mysterious ways. I will permit one or two questions because we are a bit over time, and then it's a short break. Any questions or isn't it?
Which company?
Norway Post.
Oh, Norway Post, okay. I've worked with Itella, which is the equivalent in Finland, right?
Of the line, so to speak, being erased with us being employed at one place and being employed at one place.
Mm-hmm.
Do these channels apply more to businesses than previously? Is there a solution there?
So let me understand. Are you asking basically the sort of future of work question, that people used to be locked up in their business, let's say intellectual property got created within the business, and the purpose of the business was to shield its creation from the rest of the world? So I think
the division between business to business and business to consumer.
Got it. There are three quick answers. One is that I think companies have learned by opening up and letting others actually write to their disk, so to speak, they can profit. Example is Best Buy, $40 billion revenues in the United States, met the CEO last week. And I've done some work for them, and he says, at a conference, says, hey, we are one wiki. So whether you're an employee or whether you're a customer, you can actually, from the outside in, annotate products Best Buy has. So that's one way how these boundaries have become very pure, porous. Second thing is, if you think about IT innovation, in most cases, your kids know more about, you know, how technology works than you marketing people. I mean, where do you go to at home if, you know, you need to have some help with your mobile phone? Do you call up Nokia and, you know, stay on the line for the next 2 hours? Or do you ask your kid and say, hey, how do I do this? Okay. So we are used that at home we use a browser, and we rebel if our company doesn't allow us access to a browser in the company. It's absurd. So, you know, it is really bottom-up innovation as opposed to I, as the CIO of your company, decide on what software is good for you to use. And then the third element is that everybody more or less has a blog and has a voice. So that employee at the airline, to stick to the example, who answers a quick question the customer has without actually, you know, putting on his hat as an employee, that is just the reality. And there's one slogan I want to point you, one website called Customer Service is the New Marketing. Customer Service is the New Marketing. And it's called GetSatisfaction.com. I can't show you. GetSatisfaction.com. That's where employees and other customers help people get their questions answered. One more question.
No, thank you. No. Because we have a schedule, so I have to be a bit cross here. So I would encourage people to ask you more questions in a short break, and then we take 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you very much.